morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those of the individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney makes no representation as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any information presented. The information is general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided and statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney Bank encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. If you have any questions, please email david.lundgren@hancockwhitney.com. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton, Investment Directors Richard Chauvin and Jeffrey Tangus. We have special guests, the Fund Manager and Senior Portfolio Manager Austin Zonbrecker, and David Lundgren, our Chief Investment Officer, will serve as a moderator.
Good morning. Thank you, Ashley. Thanks for joining this morning. No shortage of information to cover on the call today. Lots going on, especially on the trade front, and we're going to start there. And Richard, we met last. We had our call last month on May 7th, and I was thinking back to what was going on at the time. And, you know, going, I guess, towards the end of April, the numbers that we were throwing around and heard from others was that the trade deal with China was 90% done. They were just working on that last 10%. Right after that May 7th meeting, the Chinese delegation was on their way to D.C. To hopefully hammer out a deal, and things obviously fell apart, and you know, the additional tariffs were put in place with threats of more, and things really turned for the worse. And if you could, maybe give us an update on where things stand today, and then, you know, if you can, I know it's difficult, but any sort of outlook on where we may be going from here. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Yeah, those comments remind us of where we were early in May, and it seems like a long time ago now. So much has happened. I'm going to start with the most recent developments, and most of what I'm talking about happened just last week. Last week was extremely big week in trade, and mostly negative, if not all negative, development. So the first thing I was going to say is that the China state media, which is obviously government-controlled media, reported that is one of the retaliatory measures or threats. The government in Beijing has prepared a list of rare earth metals that it may restrict from export to the U.S. if that is deemed necessary. These are metals that are used in a lot of technology, lighting, lasers, things of that nature that are largely mined in China and not largely available in other countries and certainly not produced in other countries. So they've got somewhat of a monopoly in many of these rare metals. So they may get restricted. That's one of their potential strong leveraging points in this negotiation. So that was first. The second thing that happened is that in retaliation to the U.S. blacklisting the large Chinese telecommunication company, Huawei, China's decided to prepare a list of, quote, unreliable entities that are deemed to damage the interest of China's domestic companies. So they're drawing up this list. It's certainly going to include some of the major high technology companies in the U.S., and again, there may be restrictions placed on them, and the stocks of many of those stocks, such as Google and Microsoft, have seen some negative effects from that news. Haven't seen a specific announcement of those measures yet or what they would do, but it's a vague threat. An odd example was mentioned in that they called out Federal Express is a potential unreliable entity because FedEx apparently delivered a lot of packages that were meant for China coming from Japan, and they got delivered to the U.S., and apparently that angered Chinese officials. So FedEx was specifically mentioned in that release. There's a lot of hardliners in China that probably influenced the President Xi, and some of the things Trump has done, such as threatening the tariffs on additional $300 billion worth of goods, pretty much everything else that hasn't been tariffed is under threat of tariff, and the hardliners are probably thinking that we can't do business with President Trump. The Mexico tariff threat, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, probably influences him as well. Is it perhaps this man is so unpredictable, and you know his word may not mean much to them, and therefore it could make doing a deal with him very difficult. This is what some of the writings and some of the articles that we've read have said. On the other hand, there's other ways to look at Trump's actions, such as trying to convince China that he's crazy enough to follow through on threats, and so China ought to come to the table with concessions because it's almost unknown what things he might do, no matter how damaging they may be to his own interests or to the U.S. interests, just to get China's to create some pain in China to get them to concede some of the industrial policy issues that we care about. Still, we do think there's some strong incentives for this deal to get done, even though we've gone pretty far from that early May period where we had 90% of the deal written down. It looked like we were heading towards success. Some time has to go by, and we just hope that the G20 meeting coming up very shortly, where President Xi and Trump get to have a conversation, that is seems to be planned. I haven't seen specifics about it, but there have been indications that they will meet, they will talk, and that could create some de-escalation of this situation. So hopefully there's some light at the end of this tunnel, but recently, and particularly in the last week, it's looked pretty negative and continues to today. I'll leave it at that, Dave, unless you had other comments or questions about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's going to be an interesting G20 for sure, and hopefully we can get, you know, some positive developments that come out of that meeting. You mentioned Mexico, and last week I think it was a bit of a surprise. I don't think anybody really anticipated that President Trump announced imposing 5% tariffs on goods imported from Mexico starting June 10th. Next week. Mm-hmm. And the tariff rate would rise 5% each month up to 25% in October until the flow of Central American migrants through Mexico to the U.S. is halted or slowed. Give me your thoughts on that. And you mentioned how it impacts the negotiations with China. But how do you see this playing out? Is this sort of just a short-term threat? And, you know, again, I know it's hard to sort of predict, but how do you see this working?
I tend to think it's a threat, but I, again, not high confidence, but I tend to think it's a threat that likely won't be carried out. I'll give you some points that we've learned about concerning this that lead me to feel that way, but I won't discount it as completely worthless, and I think it could have an impact on the China negotiations, either positively or negatively, as I mentioned. Peter Navarro, the assistant to the president and the director of trade and manufacturing policy, had an interview last week where he stated on the White House lawn that the flow of these Central American migrants through Mexico after crossing the southern border needs to be stopped, and Mexico needs to do more to stop them. He indicated that really not anything was being done. Mexico would dispute that, but he called the Mexican government as bystanders to this flow of people through the country. And obviously Trump wants it stopped or significantly slowed. No quantification of that was given, but he wanted progress made on that. One comment you probably won't hear the Mexican foreign minister mention. I understand he's come to the United States to discuss this with U.S. officials, is that there are some who believe that Mexico is not particularly effective in stopping this flow, even if they wanted to. And unfortunately, that's because of corruption in the Mexican government, and the cartels, who have tremendous power, make a business out of having these migrants come through Mexico. They pay in these cartel members to get them through the country. They provide transportation, housing, food, and bring them into the United States for a fee. So this is something the cartels live off of and don't want it stopped. And there's some indication that the Mexican officials throughout the regions of Mexico participate in this and really are kind of coerced into helping with it. So that would be an embarrassing thing for the president of Mexico to admit, but there's some belief that that is the case. So in that case, you couldn't expect much help if that is indeed true. On the other hand, Trump may be using it again as a leverage for China to say, look at what I'll do if you know, and how far I'll go to get concessions. I'll even do this, and which is certainly going to have an impact on the U.S. economy and on auto prices here, because you know, those are consumer items that come into the U.S., and those tariffs, as they go up, will definitely have an impact on not only Mexico but on U.S. The U.S. economy.
It sounds like a perfect segue to Paul, Richard. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, that was there's a lot going on, so Paul probably has some comments related to the economy as well, so I'll turn it over to Paul.
Yeah, let's go ahead and, Paul, talk about the economy a little bit. And, you know, obviously all this trade friction, I think, is going to have some sort of impact. And 2018, you know, the consumer really was a powerful force in driving the economy here in the U.S., and so far in 2019, you know, granted, a lot of these trade tensions are, I guess, rekindled in the month of May and may not be fully incorporated in the data. The consumer seems to be still pretty healthy. We can't seem to get any movement on the business spending side. And I think a lot of it is just around the uncertainty. So if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more on that, and talk to us about where we are here in the second quarter and maybe, you know, what the second half might look like given all the different variables in play. Paul?
Yeah, thank you, Dave. So just want to say I'm kind of struggling with some allergies, so please forgive the voice a little bit. I'll try to make it worth it. And we'll certainly address the U.S. economic outlook. I did want to have a little broader view and kind of cover the waterfront of the main issue here in 2019 being slowing global growth. So the IMF reported in April that they were reducing their estimate for 2019 global real GDP growth from 3.5% to 3.3%. And so to put that in a little context, we think basically 3% global growth is sort of a stall speed and kind of a worrisome level of global growth. So we're a little uncomfortably close to that global stall speed at 3.3. 3.3 is down from 3.7 and 3.8 the last couple of years in 2017 and 2018. So we're seeing a pretty significant slowdown in global growth. A little more context, the global economy since the 2008 crash has mostly trended in a 3 to 4% range. So the U.S. growth has struggled to get traction, and that was true for the global economy as well over the last decade. Historically, global growth, real global growth runs in a 4 to 5% range, which 5.5% was what we saw in 2007, 3% in 2008, and flat in 2009. So that's sort of the backdrop. Slowing global growth is the theme, and that's certainly the theme in the United States this year as well. Although there is, you know, looking under the hood and getting into the numbers, a lot of it is more technical than fundamental. we do think the U.S. economy is basically on pretty good shape, strong employment growth, good, healthy consumption, and just kind of struggling with a couple of near-term noisy quarters, and primarily the first quarter, which came in at 3.1%. We think was basically a big inventory build that masked weak consumption. Consumption was weak because of a number of noisy, weird factors in the first quarter, including the government shutdowns, the polar vortexes, and then the inventory build was a result of trade driving a big import surge in the fourth quarter, trying to beat the January 1st tariff increases. So looking at the second quarter, the paradox is that the top line number is probably going to look on the weak side, say 1.5 to 2%, but we think under the hood, the real PCE will look pretty healthy, and there will be an inventory drawdown that pushes the real GDP number lower. So that's actually not a bad situation in that it sets up a more balanced growth economy in the second half, with inventories sort of back into under control, which should give U.S. manufacturing some breathing room to ramp up a little bit and catch up with U.S. consumption. So our base case for 2019 has been growth around 2.5%. We'd call it 2 to 2.5%, and focusing on the high end of that, given strong consumer fundamentals. And the trade situation is certainly a risk factor that leads us to wonder if really growth could slow to the lower end of that, towards 2%. And so that's kind of where we're leaning, although, as Richard indicated, it's all pretty fluid and pretty hard to assess the timing on when any of that could hit. Just suffice to say, the U.S. economy, compared to the rest of the world, is in pretty decent shape at 2.5% growth. Just briefly, elsewhere, the Eurozone continues to flirt with stall speed with 1.2% growth in real GDP on a year-to-year basis through the first quarter. So as in the U.S., we tend to look at the year-to-year real GDP trends as indicative of underlying trends more than noisy quarter-to-quarter numbers. And so the 1.2 in Europe compares to peak growth around 2.5%, in the middle of 2018. Expectations are that Europe will continue to grow relatively sluggishly around 1.4% for the rest of this year. So that's pretty sluggish. We could have a conversation about how Brexit plays into that. I think I'll move on and cover China rather than get into the weeds there. And then the bottom line is that Brexit has just been a drama that won't go away, but is cost the British government to change. And basically the EU has set conditions for the exit that are just unacceptable to any British government. So we think that the outcome is that Brexit slowly goes away one way or another as a factor that could disrupt global growth, either through referendum or renegotiation. But the current deal on the table from the EU is unacceptable. The other major engine of growth in the world is China, which continues the long march of deceleration as its economy matures and struggles with a heavy debt load. In 2017, China grew real GDP at a 7% rate. In 2018, 6.4%. 2019 is expected to be 6.2%, and 2020, 6.0%. So the last few years have been characterized by fiscal stimulus in the form of provision of cheap credit to the provincial governments and the state-owned enterprises, which have resulted in an alarming jump in the non-financial debt-to-GDP ratios there, and indicative of a heavy debt load. In 2018, the People's Bank of China went pedal to the metal on lowering the cost of that credit and other monetary stimulation that in magnitude was on par with the QE that had occurred in the U.S. in recent years. Very substantial. But so far, there are only tentative and preliminary signs of growth traction in China, and China's economic patterns look very similar to the downshifting in global growth seen elsewhere. So connecting these global dots, what we see is sharply decelerating manufacturing production around the world, and global purchasing manager indexes under 50% expanding, basically. Global trade volume, meaning real inflation-adjusted global trade, stalling abruptly in the last 6 months, with growth dropping from 5% trends to zero. We see leading indicators in the OECD and BRICS, that would be the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, that's all the developed economies, plus the BRICS being the biggest of the emerging market economies. So the combination, basically a pretty good proxy for the global economy. Leading indicators for that produced by the OECD have been falling for the last 12 months and gaining downside momentum. So, again, our concern is that global GDP in 2019 at 3.3% is a precariously hazardous situation, with growth close to stall speed for the global economy. So, and now we have trade war risks that I guess I'm going to pass the baton, let others speak, but the short version is it's a lot of uncertainty around that, a lot of drama, a lot of positioning, but the risk of disruption, we think, probably lead us to lower our expectation for U.S. growth, not lower at this point than 2% this year. So cutting the view from 2.5, relatively modest, steady growth, to 2, so we would call, if we saw trends drop below 2 and head to 1.5, we would start to worry about stall speed in the U.S., but we don't see that at this point. So back to you, Dave.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it. Austin Zonbrecher, good morning.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. You heard Richard and Paul's comments, and obviously a lot of risk out there, and the trade tensions that really took a turn in May have led to a pretty, no other way to put it, but just sloppy market. And, you know, there weren't a lot of winners in the month of May, a lot more volatility on news headlines after a great start to 2019. First 4 months were pretty incredible, but definitely saw a pause and a pullback. So if you could maybe detail the month a little bit, and then let's go ahead and move into, you know, maybe where we go from here. So, Austin?
Sure. Well, I'm happy to be on the call, Dave. I was last on the call back in December, which, of course, was the last negative month before May. So I'm starting to get the impression you guys just bring me on to be the bearer of bad news. As you mentioned, the MSCI ACWI, which is that broad global benchmark, was down almost 6% for the month of May. U.S. stocks did slightly worse. They were down about 6%. The S&P was down 6.5%. The Russell 2000 small caps were down almost 8%. And then international developed and emerging markets were also down about 7% for the month. That doesn't take into account, however, what's happened year-to-date, and we still have very strong returns year-to-date. The ACWI is up over 9%. The S&P nearly 10%. The Russell 2000, the small caps, almost 9%, and then the international and emerging markets are both up solid single digits as well. So even though the month of May we saw some of the concerns come back into the market and the pullback, year-to-date returns have still been very strong. From a sector standpoint, Really, there was nowhere to hide in May. Real estate was the only sector that had a positive return. It was up 0.9%. Utilities also had a strong sector return. The worst performing sectors were energy and then somewhat surprisingly technology. So technology, which has been a fairly strong leader for a while, has entered over the past few days an official correction that is being down more than 10% with some of the news that happened on Monday. Technology, energy, and materials were the most negative from an earnings perspective as well. And speaking of earnings, most of the S&P 500 companies have reported earnings. 492 out of 500 have reported their first quarter earnings, according to Bloomberg. And we've seen earnings growth of about 1.5%, which is, and about 66% of those companies have had positive earnings growth. Again, the laggards were in energy, technology, and materials. That 1.5% earnings growth number is the lowest that we've seen on the S&P 500 since the second quarter of 2016, so a bit of a slowdown there. And then from a what we call an earnings surprise perspective, that is what the Wall Street expects earnings to be for certain companies versus what they actually report, we saw a 6% positive earnings surprise. About 77% of the companies in the S&P 500 were positive. What's been a little different in the first quarter that we haven't seen is the impact of those surprises. So the five-year average of a positive earnings surprise typically sees a stock go up 1% the day the surprise is announced. This year, it was only, or this quarter, it was only up 70 basis points. And from a negative perspective, companies that missed earnings and had negative surprises, on the average 5 years, those stocks have gone down 2.5%. This quarter, they went down 3.5%. So in other words, we're seeing stocks not getting that boost from positive earnings surprises and be hurt larger than normally from negative earnings surprises. Looking forward for the second quarter, we've seen some major banks, Bank of America, Citigroup recently came out and cut their earnings estimates slightly for the second quarter, based on some of the trade rhetoric, so certainly keeping an eye on what's going on from a macro perspective. But that wraps up May. Going forward, for what we see happening in the future, so this correction, we've seen stocks from May 1st, from their May 1st highs, go down about 7%, and it's been 34 days. Since the 2009 market bottom, we've had 24 corrections of at least 5% in the market, and they've averaged about down 9.5% and 44 days in length. So we're on the early end, but these corrections happen at least twice a year historically, and it's certainly something we're keeping an eye on. So nothing out of the ordinary with this type of market downturn that we saw in May. On the technical side, we've reached the level where a lot of the stocks appear to be hitting oversold levels, meaning there could be a short-term bounce in some of the stock market, like we're seeing today. On a more intermediate-term side, Richard and Paul both touched in great detail on what's going on with trade tensions. I think most market participants at this point in time expect kind of a muddle through of closing the trade deals, and any kind of quicker resolution could be a positive for markets going forward. On the other hand, one of the things that we look at and that's gotten a lot of news that Jeff's going to talk about here in a second is a rate cut and the Fed cutting rates and how that can impact the market. Since the 1970s, there's been a lot of rate cuts. There's been several rate cuts, and 3 months from the beginning of the rate cut, the stock market has had a pretty wide disparity of returns, anywhere from up 12% 3 months after the rate cut to down 26% 3 months after the rate cut, with an average of negative 3%. That's just to say that interest rates might not be the overall panacea for the market that some participants are expecting. So with that, I'll wrap up and send it back to you.
Great. Thank you, Austin. We'll have you on when we have a good market one time.
Appreciate it.
Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
So obviously the bond market was not immune to all the things that we've discussed so far. A lot of risk brought into the equation, which typically leads investors to find safety, and they definitely have tried to find safety in treasuries. We saw yields drop quite considerably, and really all the way from 2 years out to 10 years, you know, you had yields drop anywhere from 40 to 50 basis points in the you know, matter of 30 days, which is, you know, from a historical perspective, pretty big jump down. And I guess the expectations, you heard Austin touch on it, of the Fed cutting rates in 2019 have risen considerably in the face of maybe some slower economic data. So if you could maybe talk a little bit about what's going on the bond market. Do we break 2 on the 10% on the 10-year yield? And what do you think the Fed's going to do? So a lot of questions in there, but take it from here, Jeff.
Well, you hit it right on the head, Dave. The bond market really, in general, had a great month during the month of May. Intermediate bonds, according to the Bloomberg Barclays Index, aggregate index, intermediate aggregate index, was up 1.32% for the month. That's not an annualized number. That's just a raw monthly number. So a great return for bonds, and unfortunately it's on the backs of all the negative news that's come out that's affected the stock market and high yield bonds and other risk type assets. Most of that return came as a result of a rally in the treasury market. You're right, from about 2 years on out to 30 years, treasury rates dropped about roughly 40 basis points during the one-month period on trade concerns and indications of slower global growth that Paul touched on. So it was an unusual month. It was somewhat of a capitulation month. It looks to me like the Mexico tariff threat that came right just recently, last couple of days, last week or so, really was what caused the capitulation. We saw high yield spreads widen out dramatically just in the past week. Apparently, the high yield market is much more sensitive to the Mexican trade than the Chinese trade. So a lot of moving parts in the last month. One of the other things that you hear a little bit about is the curve inversion from basically the 3 months out to 10 years is a textbook harbinger of slower economic growth ahead, sometimes even recession, and that went negative by about 20 basis points. So that's worrisome. It's not necessarily the last word, but it's something that bears watching. Actually, when we met last month, the Fed had just met, and so we touched on a little bit of the May 1st commentary after that Fed meeting. And we have another Fed meeting. Let's see. Looks like it's later on, mid June. It looks like. So we haven't had a Fed meeting since we met last, but there has been a lot going on at the Fed with speaking. Chairman Powell, as a matter of fact, is speaking right now in Chicago, and we're looking for hints or clues as to what the Fed may be, which way they may be leaning, given the Mexico situation now as well. And from what I see on the headlines, Powell is making very clear that the Fed does stand ready to support the markets, support the economy via rate cuts if necessary, because of some of the turmoil that the trade situation may bring. So he's trying to talk the markets down a little bit and calm them down. Another aspect of all this is inflation. Inflation expectations are dropping, as we have said on this call quite often. The Fed's out loud target is 2%. inflation. And right now, near-term inflation expectations, say over the next 5 years, are about 1.6% annual. Longer term, about 1.75, so well short of what the Fed has said they want to see. And that is one of the reasons why the people who are calling for a cut at the Fed are saying it's necessary, because inflation expectations are really dropping, and actually actual inflation. We're seeing some numbers that are coming in on the weak side as well. So inflation is not doing exactly what the Fed wants it to do. So a reason, again, why people think the Fed may have to cut. But really, the out loud conversation, generally speaking, out of the Fed, is the Fed is still in patient mode. They think the economy is in good shape, the U.S. economy domestically is in good shape, and that they don't have a bias right now to hike or to cut rates. So they're still talking a good game, but we're starting to see a few more Fed governors speaking publicly, laying the groundwork for a possible rate cut if it becomes necessary because of all the trade dislocation that's taking place. So we'll be looking for what kind of commentary that comes out of the June 19th meeting. Right now, market probabilities, Fed Fund futures say it's 86% probable the Fed doesn't do anything at this meeting. So clearly no one is looking for action right now. But looking out farther beyond that, the market within the last week or so has added a second expectation for a cut, an additional cut this year. So right now, the market via the Fed Funds futures are pretty clear in the consensus, 87% probability of the first cut by September, and about 78% chance that they cut a second time before December. Our view is that the U.S. economy is in good shape, that those cuts are really not warranted because of what the lay of the land as we see it right now, but that the Fed may still see a cut necessary if global growth continues to slip and the trade situation continues to linger, and you know, which it's hard to tell which way all that's going to turn right now. You could tell that from Richard's commentary. But if those things start to drag on the global economy, you could see the Fed coming in with a cut just to support market psychology and to help spur a little bit of global growth. So so the Fed's got a lot on its plate right now. We saw Australia cut rates, overnight rates, for the first time in 3 years. German yields are negative 21 basis points. So clearly outside our borders, there's plenty to keep an eye on there. Our 10-year rates at about 2.12%. Our 2-year rates at 1.9, both of those down again about 40 basis points from last month. On the corporate bond market, corporate bonds, even though spreads widened, corporate bonds are still up 1%, trailing treasuries, but still up about 1%, intermediate corporate bonds, that is, during the month of May. So corporate bonds trail treasuries, but still had a pretty decent month overall. The one place that did take some licks during the month of May was high-yield bonds, as I mentioned earlier, highly impacted by the Mexico tariff threat. And they behave more like stocks than bonds these days. So that's an area to keep a close eye on. Dave, those are my prepared comments for the bond market for the month of May. I'll turn it back over to you now.
Great. Well done, Jeff. And thank you very much, everyone, for joining us this morning. Join us next month when our call will be on Tuesday, July 2nd. Thank you.